Hi, this is Dan Melton. Thanks for joining us for this podcast of St. Andrew's Weekly Message. I hope you enjoy it. I encourage you to listen through the words to what God is saying to you, and may the peace of God be known through your life this week.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I appreciate being here. I did want to start by saying Happy Father's Day to my dad down in North Carolina. Also, I have my father-in-law, Richard, here. Happy Father's Day to him and Jason, who is dutifully taking care of the babies while I give the sermon. So he's doing dad duty on Father's Day. So I'll begin with this. It's kind of a funny story because, as we've decided, stories about toddlers are always a good way to break the ice. So on one of my recent drives to North Carolina, we visit family down in North Carolina frequently. We were about 7 or 8 hours into a very long drive, and my three-year-old son, Jesse, asked me in his polite little tone, he said, "Mommy, you please turn on to hotspot." Well, mind you, Jesse doesn't have a tablet or an iPad. I did not have him, he was not looking at my phone or anything. I'm a mom who's fairly hesitant to let my toddlers do a lot of screen time, but clearly mine knows the lingo, and he asked me for a hotspot. So I said, "What in the earth, Jesse, what on earth do you need a hotspot for?" And he said, in his sweet little voice, "Well, of course, Mommy, to get me all warm and cozy." Well, there we go, a desire more elementary than a dopamine rush of games and shows. The desire instead to be warm and cozy. And in that particular moment, Jesse was strapped into his car seat. He couldn't climb in my lap for a book or a snuggle, so he reached out for the next best thing, a hot spot. The need for physical reassurance is pervasive throughout life, and older children and adults seek out bodily comfort as well. We throw out socks that have too big a toe seam in them, and we play frugal weatherman with our thermostats every day. We love to pat and nuzzle golden retrievers in the park, even if they're not ours. And when our love language is not physical touch, we still have mood changes and we perform more efficiently when we're touched by another human being. An NPR story called Morning Edition spoke to this particular notion. It said this: "We'll start on the outside, with the skin. It's our largest organ, covering about 20 square feet, which is the size of a mattress. If somebody touches you, there's pressure pushing on your skin at the point of contact. And just under the skin are pressure receptors called Pacinian corpuscles. The Pacinian corpuscles signals go directly to an important nerve bundle deep in the brain called the vagus nerve. The vagus sometimes is called the wanderer because it wanders all through the body, and it has branches that go to several internal organs, including the heart. It's the vagus nerve that actually lowers our heart rate and lowers our blood pressure. Hand-holding or hugging also decreases a stress hormone called cortisol. Having a friendly touch or just somebody touching our arm or holding it buffers the physiological consequences of stress. In addition, a friendly touch also increases oxytocin, which is considered the cuddle hormone. It's a neuropeptide which basically promotes feelings of devotion and trust and bonding. Oxytocin levels go up with holding hands and hugging and with therapeutic massage. And this cuddle hormone is what makes us feel close to one another. It lays the biological foundation and structure for connecting with other people. Bo Reinhardt is a guitarist from the band Need to Breathe, one of my favorite bands. Lucky for me, my oldest daughter Amelia also likes Need to Breathe, and she has them on her playlist, and her iPhone is almost always paired with my Bluetooth in the van, because that's what teenage daughters do. They pair their devices with your Bluetooth. So anyways, I'm lucky because we like the same music. So Bo, this guitarist, he wrote a song called Something Beautiful about encountering God and specifically about being divinely inspired when he was in a most desperate state. The words of the chorus go like this: This is my desire. Consume me like a fire, because I just want something beautiful to touch me, to know that I am in reach, because I am down on my knees. I'm waiting for something beautiful. So on that same trip to North Carolina, when Jesse asked me for the hotspot, I was singing this song with the van sound system and Bluetooth. And like Jesse, I wanted to be touched, and touched in a way that felt lovely and warm and inspired beauty within me. And so, in thinking of offering this sermon, I was led to explore an encounter in which the early disciples were also touched by Jesus. The Gospels of Luke, Mark, and Matthew all present this encounter. It's commonly referred to as the Transfiguration, but they do it in slightly different ways. And so for today, we're going to dive into Matthew's version. In this story, the disciples are shown the brilliance of Jesus and are introduced to the notion, for really one of the very first times, that their friend Jesus was actually God's son and not just another Jewish teacher or prophet. So let's read Matthew 17, verses 1 through 8, and this should be in your bulletin. After 6 days, Jesus took him with Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah, talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus. In Matthew's version of the Transfiguration, the setting is believed to be atop Mount Tabor, which is a central hilltop, and even today it offers stunning views of the Valley of Galilee. It kind of reminds me of Sugarloaf Mountain and how it comes up all by itself in southern Frederick County, and you can see lots of the Potomac and all the little towns around. But Jesus and his friends were not hiking for a view. They actually were hiking to the top of the mountain to find a quiet and peaceful and strong place to pray. So now let's shift to the characters of this story. There's 2 sets of characters to pay attention to here. First, you've got Peter, James, and John. They're the onlookers. But the central characters in the story are actually Jesus and Moses and Elijah. Historically, Moses represented God's law, and Elijah represented God's prophets. They're both holy characters and immensely crucial to the covenant story. In fact, the roles that Moses and Elijah played in the covenant story were so important that Peter thought, "I'm going to memorialize them alongside of our newcomer, Jesus, with special tents." Right there on the mountain, he offered to put up a tent for Moses and celebrate the law and how the law set the Jews apart and their relationship with God was special. And then a few feet away, he would set up another tent, and in this tent, he would honor Elijah. And this was to memorialize Elijah's challenge of Ahab and his god called Baal. I think Dan's talked about that a couple times recently, actually. Elijah was a pivotal character in understanding that our God was actually the one and only true God. And so then Peter said, "You too, Jesus, we can make a tent for you. Clearly, God has aligned you with Moses and Elijah. Why else would you be standing right in front of me next to 2 of my heroes, shimmering, shining, white, light, bright, and all this glory?" Now, many assert that the illumination of Jesus proved his divinity for the first time to the disciples. But N.T. Wright, who's one of my favorite New Testament scholars and Dan references frequently, he explains that this is not entirely accurate. First of all, he says that Moses and Elijah were shining too, and we just talked about how they're an important part of the covenant story, but they're not divine. In other words, they're not partly God. Furthermore, shining apparently is a gift that will be bestowed to all of us mere believers. Jesus himself, earlier in Matthew chapter 13, says, "Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father." So if Jesus is shining and being all bright and glorified is not presenting his divinity, then what's the purpose of all the shining and the glory? So N.T. Wright, again, to the rescue, he offers another trail for us to follow. That is, he offers a fascinating parallel between the story of the Transfiguration on a mountaintop and the suffering of Christ on a hilltop. He says this, "For the New Testament writers in general, humanity itself is a glorious thing, and Jesus' perfect humanity provides the model for glory which all his people will one day share. If you want to see Jesus' divinity, the early Christians would tell us, you must look, however surprisingly, at Jesus' suffering and shameful death. The mountaintop explains the hilltop and vice versa. Perhaps we really only understand either of them when we see them side by side with each other. Learn to see the glory in the cross and the cross in the glory, and you'll have begun to bring together the laughter and tears of a God who hides in the cloud and the God who is to be known in the strange person of Jesus himself." Wright goes on to demonstrate more of these eerie parallels among the two events. In one, Jesus is revealed in glory. In another, Jesus is revealed in shame. In one, Jesus is flanked by Moses and Elijah. And in the other, Jesus is flanked by two criminals. In one, a bright cloud overshadows the scene. And in the other, darkness comes over the land. In one, Peter blurts out how wonderful it all is. And in the other, the same exact Peter hides from and denies Jesus. In one, the voice of God declares that this is his wonderful son. And in the other, a pagan soldier declares in surprise that this really was God's son. In the Transfiguration story, God surprises the disciples first with the glowing Jesus, Elijah, and Moses, and then he surprises them further with more bright light, more clouds flooding all over them. None of this, though, is making it any clearer to the disciples. They're as confused and befuddled as ever. And in the midst of all this confusion, God, his voice comes out deep, booming, and authoritative, and it says, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." Apparently, the voice itself was surprising as the light and the cloud and the dead men who've come back to life, because Matthew says that on hearing this voice, the disciples fell face down and terrified. My one-year-old Simon witnessed his first really big thunderstorm recently. We were enjoying dock time down in North Carolina, the same trip that we had driven down there, and a dark cloud was across the lake. The wind started to pick up, and we could see it moving towards us. So the big kids and I swooped up all the rafts, got them tucked away. We put the boat on the lift. We collected towels and babies and ran up to the house. And just about that time, the rain started trickling. Well, I love a good thunderstorm, so we went out onto the screened-in porch to enjoy this encounter with Mother Nature. It was raining. There was a little bit of lightning. There were rumbles of thunder. And before long, this humongous boom crack was just deafening. I mean, it sounded like the whole house split in two. Well, all of us kind of looked at Simon, and we said, "Simon, isn't it cool? Isn't this the neatest thing?" Well, he burst into tears, ran, buried his head in my lap, and said, "Scary." So I imagine the disciples felt a little bit like Simon in this story. They've got clouds, light, and then a boom of God's voice, and they behaved much like my one-year-old, face down, terrified. But here's where the story softens a little bit. The disciples were scared, their eyes tightly closed, and Jesus responds, much as he often does, by touching them. He touches them to let them know that he's there and it's safe to look up. Jesus applied pressure to the disciples' shoulders, specifically their Pacinian corpuscles, which signaled the vagus nerve, which slowed their heart rates down, decreased their blood pressure. His touch decreased the levels of the stress hormone called cortisol, thereby buffering the physiological consequences of stress. In addition, oxytocin began to surge. Remember, oxytocin promotes feelings of devotion, trust, and bonding. Peter, James, and John were the benefactors of human touch in a moment when they needed it badly. not only human touch, but the touch of Jesus himself. And once they had calmed and relaxed enough to hesitantly look up to who they were connecting with, they saw no one except Jesus. God's proclamation is sealed with Jesus' touch, and that's the part of this story that I would argue presents Jesus' divinity. I was raised in a church, and I don't remember a conversion or a born-again moment per se. I do remember an evening when I was about 16. I went to a Young Life camp in North Carolina, and I listened to a message about an orange, and it represented my heart, and then life can tear the orange apart. The orange got stabbed with knives. It was peeled. It was left bare and exposed to all sorts of hurts. And because of the cross and the resurrection, the speaker argued that Jesus wraps the orange up in his hands, which was foil, and the inside can remain sweet and good and protected. So after this kind of version of a gospel presentation, we were sent outside for quiet reflection. I didn't really know what to think. I had been loved deeply by parents, and I had always known a God who created me and protected me, so the message just didn't really resonate that deeply. But as I sat on that mountaintop, a deep fog set in, the sun began to go down, the breeze was picking up, and I remember feeling a little bit chilly. I closed my eyes and prayed that God would touch me in some meaningful way. And as I did, I perceived a pressure sensation on my shoulders, and a warmth crept across my back, and I couldn't really put my mind around the experience, but it seemed to me that God was reaching out to touch me, to let me know that he was there, and it was just him and me, no one else. I felt that he was telling me that seeking his presence would be worth my while from then on, and thus began my adult pursuit of loving God and relying deeply on his presence. The story of the Transfiguration reminded me of this desire for connection and God's faithful response to that desire with the gift of touch. The account in Matthew is actually the only one of the gospel stories that mentions that Jesus actually touched his disciples, but either way, the story has a remarkable ability to draw us into the scriptures and help us apply them to our daily ongoing lives. I'm going to finish by reading Barbara Brown Taylor's Charge. She's a pastor that I love, her writings. She also has a collection of sermons that she shares, and this is a particular writing that she gave on the Transfiguration. And she says this, "But even in congregations that welcome signs and wonders on a regular basis, there seems to be a consensus that life in Christ means trading in your old certainties for new ones. Once you emerge from the cloud, you're supposed to be surer than ever what you believe. You're supposed to know who's who, what's what, where you're going in life and why. You're supposed to have all the answers to the important questions. And when you read the Bible, you're supposed to know what it means. You have your Christian decoder ring on, now use it. But what if the point is not to decode the cloud, but to enter into it? What if the whole Bible is less a book of certainties than it is a book of encounters, in which a staggeringly long parade of people run into God, each other, life, and are never the same again? I mean, what don't people run into in the Bible? Not just terrifying clouds and hair-raising voices, but crazy relatives, persistent infertility, armed enemies, deep depression, along with life-saving strangers, miraculous children, food in the wilderness, and a knee-wobbling love. Whether such biblical encounters come disguised as good or bad, they have a way of breaking biblical people open, of rearranging what they think they know for sure, so that there's room for more divine movement in their lives. Sometimes the movement involves traveling from one place to another. Sometimes it means changing their angle on what is true and why. And sometimes it involves the almost invisible movement of one heart towards another." So friends, today I leave you with this. I pray that you will boldly seek encounters with God when you desperately need the touch of something beautiful. I pray that you will look forward to shining and shimmering among other believers. I pray that you would seek the glory in the cross, and the cross in the glory, and that Jesus would continue to surprise you with his touch so that you feel his presence in each of your days. Thank you.